This podcast is brought to you by The Shift.
Hello, guys and gals. Welcome to this week's The Last One to See. David, my darling, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you. How are you doing, Kate? Big week with the move happening.
I'm coming to you surrounded by boxes and suitcases. I have finished up my job here in Birmingham, and in a very un-me move, because I was looking at my CV and it's like, there are no gaps. I'm taking a little bit of time before I start a new job. So I'm coming back to Dublin for a month, which I'm very excited about. Obviously, mainly to see David.
Excellent.
But also, we've got some really great guests lined up. So very pumped for that, for the next chapter in The Last One to See saga.
I feel you've timed this incredibly well between Ireland reopening its doors to the world, coming back right on time, getting a load of episodes recorded. It's kind of looking promising for the beginning of 2022.
It's mainly so we can eat our way around Dublin.
Fully.
This is the plan. So what have you been up to? What have you been watching in the end of my absence?
I feel that those two questions are basically the same, because what I've been up to has just mostly been watching things. On the movie front, I've racked up quite a few. The new Scream movie I went to see, was that last Friday or the Friday before?
Five Cream,
as a yes. I refuse to call it the same title as the 1996 movie. But yeah, Five Cream, I actually did really, really enjoy it as the whole requel thing. It touches on plot points of the original and kind of brings them back in well, but brings in enough new elements that it actually does keep it fresh and doesn't feel like one of the kind of tired reboots or sequels that there's definitely been a few of. And then after that, I also got to a preview screening of Parallel Mothers last week, which...
Oh, you fancy.
Yeah,
shout out to our Spanish listeners also.
Had to represent the Church of Spain for our loyal Spanish listeners. But yeah, so when I was in college, it was kind of assumed that anyone who studied Spanish was obsessed with Almodovar, and I consider myself part of that cohort. So Parallel...
Almodovar Hive.
Funny. But really, really recommend. I think this is one of his strong ones.
The trailer looks great, and Penelope Cruz looks A, luminous, and B, brilliant. Yeah. Because I think I feel like she's never really gotten her props in English language cinema for what an amazing actress she is.
Yeah, yeah. Because exactly, this is the thing with this one, that it pairs down to a very, very small cast. Like, there's really only maybe three or four kind of main characters you're interacting with the whole time. And it almost has a feeling of theater then. All of the setup and the context of it, it's quite indoorsy, and it can all work within rooms and doesn't need big elaborate set pieces. So it's that kind of stuff where the acting really, really shines, and it's theater performances.
And obviously the roles and things are definitely changing, and as we've discussed before, particularly in TV, but the roles for women in English language cinema, particularly when we were in college, so in the early noughties, early to late noughties, I was 04 to 08, and then you're probably 2 years behind me, are you?
Mid to late for me,
huh? Yeah. They just weren't there, in the same way. So, funny. And Pedro writes good women.
And then the other kind of things that I've continued to watch totally fits in with what you're talking about there. I watched both Being the Ricardos and The Lost Daughter, which in terms of roles for powerful women, Nicole Kidman is pivoting back to film after her insane run of TV.
Yeah, and I think two Oscar noms as well, I would say, for Nicole and for Olivia potentially.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that either movie is one that I personally would be raving about, but I think they have that kind of Oscar formula.
And there is nothing Oscar likes more than women playing other women in Hollywood.
Yeah.
As well. People playing other people in Hollywood, and Lucille Ball. And again, because I suppose I Love Lucy is a very American phenomenon that I don't even, the Golden Girls obviously made its way over, and obviously many decades later, made its way over here, but I don't think, I've no recollection of I Love Lucy ever being on TV.
I strangely have a memory of RTE potentially showing it maybe daytime when I was sick home from school kind of thing, but it not being the cultural institution that it was, primetime TV in America. And I think that's, as an Irish viewer of the movie, it makes it somewhat an interesting thing, because it's not a full history of the couple, and it's a snapshot of a specific time period in their life and how the show was performing.
Yeah.
And it does the kind of Aaron Sorkin thing of really immersing you in this little short window, but doesn't really set it up ahead of it. Like, it kind of expects you to come to the table with a bit of the context.
Yeah. And do they do a lot of walk and talks? And at any point, does Nicole Kidman say her legs go all the way down to the floor?
It's just pure Sorkin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dripping.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm unashamed sentimental liberal West Wing for life. But yeah, there are certain Sorkinies. Like, I couldn't stick the Newsroom.
I enjoyed it, but like, I don't think I gave the last season of it a go.
Think the construct of it, where it's basically people more or less reacting perfectly to events that we already know have happened. So like reacting in retrospect to things, it just didn't work for me. Speaking of Scream and a little crossover, Yasmin Savoy Brown in our other fave, Yellow Jackets.
Yes. Oh my lord, Yellow Jackets also like spreading into everywhere, because the Book of Boba Fett, I don't know if you've been watching as well.
Not yet. No, I haven't heard great things, so I haven't rushed to that one.
I like it because it has season one Mandalorian elements. I thought Mandalorian went a little bit like off the rails season two. But yeah, the character who, I can't remember, it's young Juliette Lewis, the blonde.
Plays Natalie. Her name's gone. Because she's actually one of my favourites, so I should remember.
But yeah, she appeared in Book of Boba Fett the same week that we had that crossover. And yeah, but the Yellow Jackets finale, I felt like things from episode 9 went very, not like full jump the shark, but like it went chaos energy in episode 9.
Yeah, which I think, I feel was intentional, and it just left, like, there was, obviously I don't want to spoil this because I think it is still ongoing, and I think so many people have come to it as it's been ongoing as well, that they might still be catching
up.
In terms of it being everywhere, I think I'm not sure I've ever seen anything build the momentum that it's built, you know, where it just really feels like people are getting on board with it. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. I look forward to doing a bit more of a deep dive on it on a later date, but maybe we might just pause it there so we don't give too much away.
Yes, exactly. And now that actually Yellow Jackets has wrapped up, one other recommendation I would have for folks who are looking to fill the void, it's going to be starting in a week's time on Stars Play, which is one of the slightly more obscure streaming services. And they've got a new show that was HBO Max in America, but it's called Station 11. And it features Mackenzie Davis, who we loved on Happiest Season.
I mean, she was a terrible person, but yes, she was excellent.
Terrible. Well, her redeeming role definitely would have been San Junipero.
Oh, iconic Black Mirror episode. It's gorgeous. Great soundtrack as well.
Yeah, but in the kind of theme of her post-apocalyptic work, Station 11, it's kind of a flu outbreak pandemic that leads to destruction of the world. How on the nose?
Do I have the emotional and mental space to process that?
Yeah, Station 11, it is the kind of post-pandemic dystopian show, but it jumps across different timelines. So kind of within each episode, there's sometimes temporal jumps, but they can be scattered like really, really far apart. And you're kind of Memento style, kind of like picking up pieces of the story and kind of assembling it together from the different timelines. So it, in terms of even structure and everything, I would definitely recommend Station 11 as an interesting one to get into. But yeah, you mentioned the pick for this week. So Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yes, and you're very much, both our guests, the lovely Aoife Barry and myself, are noted wusses, or neither putting his neophytes to the horror genre, if we're going to be a little bit fancier. But so you were kind of our genre guru for this one, because I know during lockdown you have been hitting some well-known horror franchises hard.
Yeah, so in October I tackled the entirety of the Halloween franchise. It's fantastic. On the Wikipedia page, they have an image that I can only describe as like a London Underground map that shows the different paths you can take to kind of watch them in sequence and which chronologies are followed and all this type of thing. So
yeah, and where you have to change for the water.
Exactly. Line. Yeah. So that's usually around Halloween too for a lot of the kind of branches that run off there. And I will also note that I didn't watch the remakes, the Rob Zombie ones from 2007 and 2009, because they're not my Halloweens.
Yeah. He of a House of a Thousand Corpses, is that guy?
Okay. Yeah.
No disrespect to him, I will not be watching that film.
Yeah, so, and then also the Horrorthon Film Festival at the IFI last October, I went to see 10 movies over the space of like 3 or 4 days. All in the horror genre.
Is your brain, did it scramble your brain a little bit?
It's funny, I've always had this love of horror movies, especially in my teens. And when I was working in my kind of like post-college years on the dark parts of the internet. I think that was the point where, like, I stepped away from horror for a bit. I was seeing it enough day to day that I kind of didn't need more of it.
I just think that is such the content moderation, which is what David is referring to. It's just an incredibly difficult career.
And so now that that stage is like in my past, my appreciation for horror has reemerged again. And I've definitely been immersing myself in the genre. But I definitely find, like, I know you were saying about your kind of worst tendencies watching it. I go into such like filmmaker mode and I'm trying to work out like how they set up scenes, or I'm spotting continuity errors, that's what kind of keeps me from stressing out. So that's my tip for anyone who's a horror wuss: just be overly analytical, and it helps. Well, cool. So will we dive into the chats then?
Yeah, with all that out of the way, you are about to hear the lovely Aoife Barry's attempt to tackle the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and we admire her for pushing herself out of her comfort zone. Today, Dave and I are delighted to be joined by the journalist Aoife Barry, who is also the host of her very own podcast, which is Get Around to It. So I know we're in safe hands culturally, but she is the last one to see, and I am absolutely terrified about this, by the way, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So yeah, firstly, as is established in this podcast, I am an enormous wuss. I need you to know I deeply resent your choice. So thanks.
I'm really sorry. I presumed you'd both seen it and be like, oh, it's grand. So,
well, actually, I think before we even jump into it, we do need to have like a point of clarification, because the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise to date has 8 movies, with a 9th coming.
Great timing.
So within that, we have the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, Leatherface, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, Texas Chainsaw Massacre The Next Generation, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, 2003. Oh, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning. Texas Chainsaw 3D, Leatherface. And then the Netflix one next year. So to clarify, we're doing the OG, 1974. We're going all the way back. Yeah.
Yes, the OG. Okay. Back to the OG. Yeah.
Well, it looks like it's news to Aoife that there were, as it is to me, that there is an entire Texas Chainsaw Massacre universe. Like, how many chainsaw
Somebody
massacres?
Somebody needs to decommission that bloody chainsaw, because there are too many massacres happening.
Yeah, clearly. And like, my understanding is that Leatherface is not some type of criminal mastermind. So like, that he's continuing to go on this spree of fairly public, extremely obvious massacres. Like,
well, I think the true crime is like most chainsaws are like powered by fuel. So it's really an environmental issue at this point, the fact that he's using it so much.
He's contributing towards our terrible carbon emissions, well, in the US anyway, so yeah, cancel him immediately, please.
So in terms of, Aoife, your, for lack of a better way of putting it, because I know it's not, the errors aren't always that kind, day job in terms of the sphere of journalism, and then kind of your obviously cultural interests in terms of like big fan of music, and then obviously all the different kind of cultural things that you do with Get Around to It. Are they very much separate things, or do they bleed into each other a little bit, or does the podcast satisfy a need that you don't get to cover in the day-to-day journalism?
Good question. So like, mostly my day job is in news journalism. So like, you're talking the COVID-19 stuff, political stuff, all the really fun stuff. It's definitely not grim looking at loads of court reports every day and being like, what's wrong with people? So that'd be like the bulk of what I do, but I also look after a lot of the culture stuff we do, but our culture coverage would be a smaller proportion of what we cover kind of compared to the news story. So I do luckily get to do quite a bit around books and film, and actually it's really getting to do the stuff in work around film over the last maybe decade or so that really kicked me off, I think, more into film, which, you know, it just wasn't, because I think when you work on certain things, you know, if you get to spend the time through work on stuff that you really like, you get even more into stuff. So yeah, so I mean, I think Get Around to It is something that probably we wouldn't have as like a product in the journal. So it's a way of getting to chat about like TV, books, film, music, but also to catch up with Lauren, my co-host, who's like one of my really good friends and who lives quite far away from me. So
sounds familiar.
We're like, how can we continue our codependent relationship when one of us leaves the country? It's like, we'll start a podcast.
While inflicting ourselves on the public.
Yeah, basically. Perfect. So you guys are all part of just like David and mine codependent relationship being taken to a different platform. So thank you all for enabling
Delighted to be part of it.
Much appreciated. And would you be a horror fan generally, or is this just something that's such a classic it almost transcends genre that you felt like you had to give it a go?
So I think, like yourself, I'm definitely a wuss. There are certain things that really freak me out more than other things. So I'm not good with like limbs being cut off or like gore, like anything gore. Like I haven't seen any of the Saw franchise, for example, because I just know I won't be able to enjoy it or deal with it. As opposed to like I get completely freaked out watching like ghost stories or even something like Halloween where it's like full of dread all the time. But I kind of, that's more of a mental thing and I don't mind watching those because it's not as bad. So it took me a long time to really get around to watching more horror films and like zombie films and stuff like that, because I always thought, oh, they're not really for me. And then some of my favorite films now actually are from that wider horror genre, like because I'd say for example like Rosemary's Baby, which I thought before I watched it was going to be really, really scary, and it is creepy and weird, but it's
unsettling,
amazing.
I would say,
yeah, it's unsettling and it's so my jam. Anything set in like the 70s, like everybody loves that genre.
My main unsettling thought is, the longer you look at Mia Farrow, you're like, could I pull off that haircut? It's like, no,
I know,
no, you,
yeah,
cannot.
You're like,
nobody,
no,
else
you couldn't
can.
No, exactly. So it's that is quite true. The fashion as well is quite incredible what she wears in that. So yeah, so over the last number of years I've been trying to watch more, but this film was one I was supposed to watch in college, and I was doing a as part of my course, doing, you know, you do like different tutorials, and we did one in film, and one of the particular ones that we did was about horror film. And I think I read about this in the course and I was like, I'm not even going to attempt to watch this because this involves stuff that I don't like. And it's always been, yeah, chainsaws killing, there's people's skin involved from what I know, faces over faces, I think. So I've always had it in the back of my mind, is like, I do need to bloody well get over myself, watch this. It's iconic, you know, it's like a seminal film, I'd imagine, in many ways in the genre. So yeah, so that's why I picked this
and one. I think it's interesting you mentioned Halloween. I, in the run up to the release of Halloween Kills, spent 2 weeks rewatching the entire Halloween franchise. But it's so interesting seeing a franchise that started, say, in the 70s and has continued up to today, how horror as a genre has changed.
Yeah.
And especially the kind of like mid-90s, even with the Halloween movies, you saw a very similar style to what was happening with the likes of Scream. And then all like the gornography of Hostel and Saw. Ugh. And all those franchises.
Because Scream is so referential. And then, yeah, as you say, and I'd be kind of like, Eva, I would tend to steer away from horror porn, if you will. So I wouldn't have gone in kind of the gore stuff. But that was like, Hostel was a massive game changer, I think, in the level of like actual violence, because so much of early horror, even like, let's say if you look at Psycho, which I saw when I was 8 years old because my father thought it was culture. Yeah, and I think that is probably where my entire wussiness stems from. He denies this, by the way, if you bring it up, because he really realizes it's probably, as parenting fails go, it's not great. But if you look at Psycho, you see nothing.
Exactly.
You don't see anything whatsoever. And it is all, obviously, the incredible music cues, the and like the power of suggestion and like of, you know, good editing.
Yeah.
Whereas like, it was like with the Hostels, whatever, it became fashionable to, you know, see that hook go in there or whatever the equivalent of it is. So it is interesting to see kind of, and then I think obviously where with things like Get Out and whatever, and obviously, you know, horror as an allegory and as a way of telling stories has always been there, you know, in an awful lot of people's work. But I think it's almost becoming more front loaded now, I think, with things like Get Out, like exploring race and whatever. It's the subtext has kind of become the text in that way.
Totally, when you look back to like the early zombie stuff, like you're talking there, it's exploring race, the idea of the other, you know. And I love all that stuff. I just think like that's so, like, so interesting to watch, I think, when you think you're, you know, the subtext is there, but you get to enjoy it on a like gory, gross level, or maybe not gory, gross level, but also in a like, you know, exploring themes that are a lot deeper and that also, like you say, change depending on the generation that you're watching it, you know, because Get Out probably has as much in common with early zombie films, you know, than anything else. But then did Hostel and Saw, like, I haven't seen those. I didn't want to go see them because I read all the discourse about them and knew it wouldn't be for me. But like, did they have any subtext to them, or did that particular era not have
my
subtext?
My understanding is, and I'm sure there are horror films who can correct us, that we're probably doing a slight disservice to collate the two of them, because I think with Saw that there is that sort of a whodunit element, and there is an awful lot of intricate plotting involved. Again, David, I don't know if you can steer us right.
Please do. I'm all ears.
Yeah, well, I suppose Eli Roth was the one behind the Hostel franchise, and I think his area of horror has always been really just like, ugh, gore, scary things. Like, it's, there's so much blood.
Yeah, hot women having terrible things happen to them.
Yeah, very much. Whereas the Saw franchise, yeah, as you say, there was a little bit more intellectualizing and almost the kind of Zodiac-style serial killer puzzle type stuff got brought in through that. But there, again, Saw as a franchise, I definitely haven't seen the 10 or 11 movies I think they've released in that world. So
David's next horror challenge.
I know. I just, there's so many.
It's mad. You need to follow that up with like a really nice franchise or something, you know.
Paddington,
yeah, like something really, you know, where you're not going to be, your brain isn't going to be tormented with images, which is amazing.
David is much better at like compartmentalizing than I am, because like I would definitely be lying awake at night, like worrying.
I do get into the very like, how did they do that kind of thing, and like I wonder where the special effects department came in. Again, that's another really interesting one, seeing modern horror versus the kind of 70s, 80s stuff where they relied a lot more on the kind of physical production,
practical effects.
Yeah.
And I find sometimes, and not to take us slightly off the horror genre, like for me, that stuff ages better, because when you look at Lord of the Rings, it still looks great. And part of it is they did so much with miniatures, they did so much with like forced perspective, and they did so much with like real stunt teams and whatever. And I think that really does help things age well when you get into more modern films, where you're kind of like, that just looks fake, and that can take you out of that moment. And especially with so much of horror is about either creating an atmosphere of, as we said, something like Rosemary's Baby, like suspense or foreboding, or something more in line with the Hostel stuff is of like, you know, brain numbing terror. So if the special effects don't work, and my understanding with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is this was to all intents and purposes a college movie.
Yeah.
But I think part of the reason that a lot of it has aged well is that there isn't any CGI. And also a lot of it is suggestion rather than the stuff that you actually see. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see that. And also, is it one of those films? Because there are certain things that were like very scary at the time that are not so scary now. Or is it something that has kept that ability to chill the blood a little bit?
Because I remember watching The Exorcist, and I'd put watching that film off for ages because I thought that it was, again, going to be something I couldn't handle. I'm obviously getting a little bit braver in my old age. But the key with The Exorcist that made it so scary for me was actually the start of it, where I was expecting something terrible to happen the whole time, and they build up the dread. And, you know, you're watching, you're second guessing everything the characters do, you know, every shot, every perspective to see in case something terrible happens. And then when you do get the special effects and the madness, because like you're saying there, it's 2021, well, when it wasn't 2021 when I watched it, but, you know, it's now and we've gone through everything. We've seen terrible violence on screen. We've seen all these awful things. So you're watching the girl's head spin around or whatever, and you're like, okay, this actually is not, unfortunately, as scary as it would have been if I was sitting in the cinema watching it in the 70s when it came out, you know? So you can benefit from that, I think, as a scary horror watcher, but you can also miss out on the joy of how terrifying it must have been to actually sit there and watch it. And
I also often wonder about, like, the medium, like, the kind of quality of home video and even, like, cinema production now, and, like, laser screenings as opposed to, like, 35mm prints and that type of thing, that it has made the photorealism almost of horror move towards that kind of thing, where I actually saw for the 20th anniversary of Scream a 35mm screening of it in like an old cinema in San Francisco, and it gave the film just this really different feel, I'd say, that it had this more nostalgic horror sense to it, where all the kind of stuff now where it's just like high-end graphics, super crisp image, it kind of, there's less of a screen between you and the film itself.
There's nowhere to hide also, as, you know, someone who has definitely curled up in their cinema chair to try and get away from the scary thing that she accidentally, unwittingly subjected herself to. Like, you can't, you know, take a breather if it's too intense, like, go out, you know, in the same way. Like, you can obviously hide in the bathroom, as I did when my mother took me to see The Little Mermaid, which was my first cinema trip, and Ursula. Now, obviously, I think she's iconic, whereas then I was just like, nope, this is very scary.
That was like me and E.T. I saw E.T. when I was 6, and I sat on my dad's lap crying for the entire film. I was so traumatised by this alien in E.T. So I think, like, we're pretty similar, Kate, in terms of our youthful forays into film.
So hopefully we'll both make it to through Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I think we will park it there because, as is the constant refrain in this podcast, we don't want to front load all our chat before we've actually managed to dive into it. You will know something's gone terribly wrong when it's just David talking to himself in studio about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and, you know, Aoife and I have expired and it's just been too much. But we are very excited to get you into studio and to talk about the seminal horror classic, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, not any of the many, many similarly named spin-offs.
Cannot wait. Thanks so much. And this has been a good excuse to watch a film that has long been on the list, and maybe we'll end up being massive horror fans after this. You never know.
Convert.
Converted. Yeah.
That's it for the preamble, so here is your courtesy warning that we're about to get into spoiler territory.
So, Aoife, welcome to The Last One to See Studio. You are now no longer the last one to see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and you survived to tell the tale by the looks of it.
I did, just about. You can't see any of my limbs that have been carved off there by a chainsaw over the last couple of days, you know, because that's the joy.
Still looking
of it.
Stunning, though.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
So we're going to throw you in at the deep end and ask, in your own words, and in no way with any level of competence, could you give us a summary of what this film is about?
Okay, it's about a day trip gone very, very wrong. It's about a group of friends who, family and friends, brother and sister, and a couple of their friends who, in classic 70s fashion, pile into the back of a van that's got no seatbelts or anything like that. They're just sitting there on it, a nice green van. They set off during a very hot summer in Texas to go visit a grave, as you do. On the way, they meet a very strange hitchhiker. You think, is this a bit of foreshadowing? Could this strange person pop up again? They meet more strange people, and then they end up going to a really beautiful old house that looks gorgeous, really empty. And that leads them to an even creepier house where they meet a family that's like the kind of American dream family gone wrong, the nightmare of all nightmares. And from there, things get progressively more horrifying. And it's definitely not one for people who don't like meat or don't like the idea of, as I wrote in my notes, human barbecue. So, yeah, that's a Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yeah.
I will say, in the strong plus column, this was, I think, about 87 minutes. And we are big believers in a brisk 90-minute film.
Oh, totally. I'm a big fan of the, like, yeah, tight 90. Yeah.
Yeah. It was efficient killing. Like, if that has, the credit has to be given where credit's due, that there, like, those bodies were knocked off in expedited fashion.
Absolute seconds. I think that's one thing that I thought would be a lot more drawn out about it. We'll probably get into that a bit more later, but I did think that the actual killing section would be a lot more drawn out, a lot more grisly, but it's really effective for how kind of grisly and terrifying it is, even though those scenes are all quite short.
Yeah, it was interesting because you texted me while you were seeing it and you were like, oh, this is like not a good one for me because of blood and gore. You actually see nothing. Like, you think you see, and they are, the other thing that I think that is seminal about this film is the first group of very beautiful, very stupid people in a horror film.
Totally.
It's just like, they're mad for wandering off. Love it. Can't get enough of it. Like, they look great while they're doing it in classic 70s fashion, but they're also very stupid.
And let's be honest, very horny. Just like, anytime they find a empty room,
they
like,
want to ride in it.
Let's capitalize on this.
Yeah. But while one of these beautiful, stupid, horny people is being put up on a meat hook, you see nothing. You see the edit.
Yeah.
The only bit of blood you see, I think, is when we get down to our final girl, because it really did invent pretty much every trope in like the standard standard slasher universe, where she gets her finger cut. And I think that's almost the only blood you see in the whole thing. And what I believe this was down to is they had no money. So this is part of the reason that they're not lashing fake blood all over. And even, firstly, you know, you have to buy fake blood and have the props and have all those things as well. But you also have to have multiples of everybody's outfits if you're doing that for continuity. So I think so much of it is really clever editing, and you think you've seen things that you actually haven't. And then I know we touched on the discussion of like torture porn and the kind of saws and hostels that came in, and you do lose that, you know, because they're like, there is no, and same with Psycho, like you never see a penetration, as they would say. It was the original kind of sharp cut editing, and you come away thinking you've seen this woman getting hacked up in the shower, but you don't see anything. And I think we've probably moved away from it a bit again, thank God. I think that was, it wasn't a show don't tell, it was like, here is everything, here is innards, here is like very extreme violence. And I think the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was probably, given obviously it was banned in multiple countries including Ireland, it was obviously considered very violent, but it is the violence of suggestion. You see nothing.
Yeah, and I think that's what's really interesting about it. It like it's about the kind of power of the human mind, like that power of suggestion. I mean, going into it, because I knew its reputation, I was texting you being like, I'm so terrified, I'm on my own in the house. I'm watching it at 6:30 PM with all the lights on so that it's
I
not
made three
too
people
scary.
Watch it with me, so there is no judgment here. It was Halloween, so I could like get it in under the wire as being, you know, this is a fun thing we can do, but really it's like I really don't want to watch this film on my own.
Very clever.
I actually found it less scary than I expected, but I think one thing that we do have to say, it is a mad bag of cats.
It's
like it
totally
is
wild. Yeah.
Yeah, and very, it's almost more unsettling than scary, because as you say, this cast of characters they meet, each one is almost creepier than the last.
Completely. And it's like one of those films where like all the characters are kind of odd in their own way, even though the young friends are, you know, they're your kind of typical hippie-ish 70s American youngsters who are like free and easy, do what they want, but they all are a little bit quirky.
I think even when we're talking typical, the like intro when they're in the car about like Planets in Retrograde and that little book she had, like
so good,
that's timeless. Like that's the new hipster girl is just as much as the 70s.
Completely.
But, like,
she'd be on Twitter. She's talking about, yeah, Saturday in Retrograde. I was like, hold on a minute. Like, it was exactly like the sort of stuff that happens now. And so they have their little quirks. And I thought there's a brother and sister relationship in it. And one element that was interesting that kind of stuck out to me was the fact that the brother is a wheelchair user. And there is that kind of idea of disability in the film that, again, in the 1970s, maybe you wouldn't be expecting it to be very subtly or very, you know, holistically done, and it's not really done, you know, in the way it might be done now in 2021. But it's still not maybe as bad as I was anticipating it to go.
There's not, and I mean this in a good way, and again, you know, as three able-bodied people,
yeah,
I'm aware that, you know, people with a disability may have another view on this, but like there's nothing really made of the fact he's in a wheelchair other than obviously the physical difficulty it causes him going around the rugged Texas landscape. You know, and also like he's comfortably the least stupid, because he's really like, there's something really not right going on here, and also is very opposed to his sister wandering off into the night to try and find the other three people who have disappeared. So I think,
I think like the one thing that recently the actor Kevin McHale, who played Artie on Glee, has like spoken out about the fact that like if Glee was being made in 2021, he would refuse. And it's that kind of thing where I'm sure that the actor who portrayed the wheelchair user in the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre was likely fully able-bodied.
Yeah.
But what I found good about the portrayal was like he seemed quite compass mentee, like they didn't do some sort of,
they didn't infantilize him
he fully knew the situation that was going on and was very, I think, probably one of the most sensible. Like the others really ventured into danger far more than he did,
with a song in their heart. Like it really was very, and even like leaving aside the fact they were unaware that they were next door to a family of murderers, which, you know, could happen to the best of us, don't go wandering around the wilderness in the dark, like at the best of times for survival advice, seems to be quite strong and a very basic tenet in staying alive.
Yeah, like I think that kind of highlights some of the stuff that maybe they're trying to explore in the film, and that idea of like the innocence versus evil, you know, because at the start of the film, you hear in the background a kind of narration is like, you know, an audio, like a radio broadcast of the news, and the news is all really terrible and grim, and that's really reflecting what the director kind of felt was going on in the US at the time, but also reflects probably like our news reports now, that a lot of it isn't like positive news and it's all pretty scary. And then
good news is no news.
And then contrasted with that, you have these like young innocent people who are kind of off to have fun for the day and kind of living that like counterculture hippie lifestyle. And so it's not surprising in some ways that they would be like, oh, like the, you know, the countryside is our playground, let's go find
this
creek,
exactly,
as they
there
do
is
on
that
stage,
kind
you
of
know?
Simpler time. And I suppose, speaking of simple, just to bring this conversation around to the iconic villain that is Leatherface, am I the only person who felt quite sorry for him during the course of this film?
Yes. I also felt that, not that you're the
like
only
it is
one.
Quite because obviously he like a Mike Myers or a Jason Voorhees or whatever, even if you're not a horror film watcher, you know where he is. But my opinion is, it was, this man who is obviously the bottom of a totem pole of an extremely abusive family. And these like teenagers kept breaking into his house and he was like, what is happening here? And you see him like absolutely losing the plot.
He was just trying to like build up his nice stock for his Etsy store of bone-based products.
Yeah,
like a bone art couch. Who wouldn't want a bone couch, I tell you.
Yeah, and like a lot of work went into that bone couch.
Really did. And like that, you know, that really speaks to the design that went into it. And yeah, like Leatherface's whole look is like, you know, the fact he's different leather faces at different points in the film, and that he's like becomes the kind of grandmother or like mother figure towards the
end.
Yeah,
definitely. I think that's really interesting like, when so they're
in
doing
my notes here. I have worn out Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh wow!
I mean, like a look. Yeah, for someone who hasn't seen this film, I think yes, just picture a man with a fake face,
with like makeup on.
The apron,
yeah, the whole I think that idea that you touched on about a very messed up American family, because that is what it is, and that's what, and they're treating Sally, our final girl, who is at the dinner table tied up, almost like a dinner guest, and it is like they're, and then they bring the grandfather down, and even when they bring this basically living corpse of their patriarch, who you assume has raised them all, because I think they're brothers. I wasn't sure if the cook was their father, but I actually think the three of them are brothers, and the very desiccated granddad is their grandfather, and you'd imagine he's the one who's raised them in this horrific environment, and they bring him down, and Leatherface in his female or feminine version is there kissing him on the head and stuff, like he is oddly sweet. And obviously, listen, he chops up people with a chainsaw. I'm not saying this is necessarily somebody that you would want to have at your own dinner party, but there was definitely something quite sad and pathetic about him that I was, and I think I would imagine, and David probably knows better than me about this, that probably disappears throughout the franchise and he kind of becomes a faceless killing machine. But there, that was something that I did not expect the poignancy of him. That was one thing, because I, much like yourself, I sort of girded my loins going into this. And then I was like, why do I feel so sorry for this man?
Yeah, yeah. Something that, like, it definitely struck me. Like, I rewatched the whole Halloween franchise recently, and Michael Myers as a character is really just kind of set up as like not really having many motivations. Like, he just kind of shows up and he's doing his thing. And I kind of got a similar vibe off Leatherface when I was rewatching this, that it's just like, even when we're talking about like his ruthless efficiency, like he doesn't like come to the screen with this malice or motive. Like, he just, like, he has a job to do. He's making his things. He needs supplies, and he just knows that he has to kill. And it's all very clinical for him in a way.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And then the family treatment is like coupled with that. You kind of see like, oh, he's kind of like, it's kind of indentured servitude.
Yeah,
because
I have a note actually very along those lines about how the Hitcher, who I think is the middle brother, and the cook, who is the older brother, kind of, the cook actually claims he doesn't enjoy hurting people, but he absolutely does. He just doesn't have the stomach for killing them. And then obviously we saw from, as you say, from the unsettling opening when they pick up this Hitcher, that this guy is tapped and definitely does enjoy inflicting pain. Whereas with Leatherface, that's definitely not the case. He just, firstly, he lashes out and dispatches these people who break into his house, which has, you know, again, I'm not saying this is an amazing course of action, but, you know, if I was
Kate McAvoy's a Leatherface apologist. Yeah,
I'm going to be cancelled for being a Leatherface apologist.
He's a killer. He's a killer, Kate.
Yeah. Yeah, I know he is. But there is that thing. Firstly, it's like they break into his house and he's like the first guy who breaks in, and they're looking for help, but they absolutely, it's like, boundaries, please. Like, they do break into the house and he hits him on the head with a hammer, and it does seem like an absolute reflex action.
Yeah, and like, I think one thing that struck me about, say you're talking about that first scene, so when the first character whose name I forget goes into the house,
Jerry and not Sally,
Jerry and Kirk,
the
and,
other girl.
Oh, is it Pam?
Pam, correct. Pam, yes, so in a very stunning pair of red hot pants. There is that iconic shot that's from kind of down low shooting up in the house is looming over her.
Yeah, which actually I was going to would have mentioned that like idea that he goes into the house and he like Leatherface catches him and then immediately dispatches him. And the like design of the house is so interesting, and the room that he comes out of, Leatherface comes out of, is like red with all of these kind of things on the wall. And I think what struck me really about the film is, like you were saying there, how stunning it is, and like the use of color at the start. It's like all like these hugely deep red tones, really like murderous blood or whatever, but shot
they really let you know what you're in for. Yeah,
they really do. Like, it's all so much foreshadowing in it, but like I thought it was really interesting. So many what I thought were like probably wide angle shots and really low angles, really interesting direction in it, where like they could have just gone like for your pretty, you know, usual way of shooting it, but instead they add these lovely artistic and interesting touches to it. And I mean, maybe that's to do with Toby Hooper's his age. I mean, he was like, what, a second feature?
I think the people who are behind the camera are pretty much the same age as the cast.
Yeah,
like, I think it is an awful lot of 20s. I assume equally hot stupid people in their 20s
exactly.
behind and in front of the camera. And I know the days were appalling and it was extremely hot, so I know it was a grueling film to make. As much as it can be grueling to watch, I think it was that was duplicated behind the camera. And yeah, I think it is, when you're looking at a film like this, and like, I'm not a horror fan, but even I with a brain in my head can see like this is a seminal piece of work as a film on its own right and in the genre. When you're watching it now, it's really easy to forget that none of this existed. Do you know what I mean? That they literally, you know, the idea, like, obviously there's been, you know, horror as far back as like, you know, 1930s German cinema and beyond, you know, and creature features and whatever. But in terms of like the modern slasher film and also the deep strangeness of the 70s and 70s cinema. And even we touched on it there, like, you know, the final girl trope of, you know, Sally doing her best to survive by jumping out of more than one window. So good for you, Sal. Yeah. Not a day to wear white jeans. I think she regretted that sartorial choice. And yeah, the beautiful dumb people and whatever, and then the very much the idea of slashers, and then even the kind of the hillbilly family as well, which I think you see in like
House of Thousand Corpses. Yeah, like I was thinking of that, like Deliverance even would have been kind of around that era, and it's something that I think has kind of disappeared a bit from film, and like
probably because it's grossly offensive
reasons that the idea of this kind of like hick inbred family being this thing you need to fear, and like everyone's safe in the city but don't go into the countryside kind of thing, definitely,
which is almost a pivot on the whole, you know, be scared of the city because crime. So it is like, you know, the real weirdos are out in like these rural these beautiful picturesque rural idols.
And maybe that actually what you're saying there speaks to what we were talking about a moment ago about you were talking about a moment ago about feeling sorry for Leatherface, because actually maybe we were at the stage now
that I have admitted this,
but no, but like maybe we're at the stage now of kind of gone through all of that culture where we're like, it is mean to say that a family of inbred people living in the countryside are, you know, like it is bad to kind of pigeonhole certain groups of people or something. And so there
we want to get them help,
you know?
We don't want to punish
them. Exactly, like you're literally like something needs to happen here to help these this family.
There is a vein in this of mine and David's possibly all-time favorite theme of it was capitalism all along, where the slaughterhouse that their grandfather worked in and that I think they potentially were exposed to or worked in has shut down, and they definitely seem to feel this is something they have to do to survive. Yeah. And like that's definitely the case with Leatherface.
That's kind of set up from the get-go of like the gas station, like not having fuel, like we're waiting
allegedly
for delivery.
They had fuel.
But
they
that,
had
like,
fuel.
It does set up an idea of this isn't really what they're relying on for income. They can't really make ends meet with the practical way, and they're kind of like using these more creative methods to like make
I do love the scene where they kind of are looking in the back fence and you just see all of these cars, and that is where I was literally like, run away.
Yeah,
you know, again, you don't have to like make a massive mental leap to be like, there is something really, really, and as you say, how like at even before the, you know, the door to basically the slaughterhouse opens up and like your worst nightmare comes out, there are so many things that are deeply unsettling about this, and they still yet, you know, in a true Elizabeth Warren fashion, they keep persisting, yet they persisted. It's just like, why won't you stop and just go away? Which is probably what I feel when watching the vast majority of horror films. It's like, please stop what you're doing. But then obviously if they do, then there's no film. So I'm aware I'm probably alone.
People don't act rationally in trauma. That's the basic.
Yeah, but they haven't been traumatized yet. They were just stupid, beautiful and stupid. But you know, mainly ended up dead for it.
And the thing is that like, I thought what was clever about it too, is that when it was originally marketed, it was marketed as a true story, so it was like that generation's Blair Witch Project, you know, like our generation's Texas Chainsaw Massacre without all of the actual killing or anything on screen, but creepiness was Blair Witch, where we kind of knew it wasn't true, but I remember watching
but
the scene and being like,
it,
I want this to be true. So I think,
and there is,
you know,
as you say, when you see so little, there is that authenticity of it could be true, even if you know it's not, you kind of buy into it. And I suppose just because you brought up there how like it was marketed as being based on a true story, it is somewhat inspired by cinema's favorite serial killer, Ed Gein, who also is credited as being somewhat of an inspiration for Psycho. So I don't know what people were doing before Ed Gein in terms of this guy, in terms of horror, but he seems to have been, as serial killers go, and, you know, the all the very gruesome things he did. He seems to have really started his own cottage industry of films that are inspired by him, which is indeed a horrifying thought in and of itself.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, just pausing there for thinking of the fact that this guy, you know, inspired a film about like masks made of human skin, I think.
Yeah.
Just kind of gives you that like moment of there are people out there like this who actually exist. And like the 1970s in particular for the US was a great serial killer time. Like, you know, you had the Golden State
Killer. Well, I think there is that element that we go into about the 70s, you really had the continuing rise of mass media.
Yeah.
So people were probably, you know, chopping the guts out of each other in the 30s, but they weren't getting as wide an appeal of it. Whereas I think, Ed Gein was almost the first mainstream serial killer. And then obviously that's been perpetuated by the fact that he is quoted as like influence, seems like inspiration. There's no word that doesn't sound like I'm saying well done, Ed. But you know that he is a seminal
that
figure.
That apologist in thread coming through again.
Yeah, I know. I think like I will settle for being like a leather-faced apologist. I want to be very clear that I draw the line of being considered an Ed Gein apologist. There was also, I think, the origin very much of the Scream Queen, and like Pam has like a grade A 5-star absolute shutdown freak out when she ends up in a room, as David touched on earlier, full of like Etsy bone art and furniture. But I think you have to like special tip of the hat to Marilyn Burns, who plays Sally, who like just does full like Shelley Duvall levels of terror, and like obviously rightfully so. She is in a truly, truly unbearable situation, but I think it is an amazing performance, and it is kind of the first one of those like really strong female performances in the that the horror genre became known for. And again, that spoiler alert, she survives.
And actually, yeah, so speaking of that, I when we were doing our little preamble before, I didn't want to hit on the spoilers before you'd watched it.
Yeah.
But that's the character that Alan Foyer is going to be playing in the sequel that's the one that's coming out next year to Netflix.
Wow. So
Grown Up Sally.
Yeah. So the actress who originally played Sally, I believe, passed away in the past like 10 years. She's like fairly recently. So they've brought her in to like step into the shoes of that role. So I think we talked about like there are a lot of installments in the franchise, but this is taking the same route as Halloween, where they're kind of disregarding all that's come before and just making it a direct sequel to the first one. So now that we've seen her get away, know that Alban's coming back.
That's so amazing.
This is where the deep trauma, I think, that you mentioned earlier, because you know, three of them are killed. Well, four of the five, three of them, maybe not Pam, are killed relatively quickly. There is actually very little time for trauma. So Sally's got like enough trauma for five people. And I did accidentally cover myself in glory when Sally jumps through her second window. She has gotten through this horrific night. She is limping down the driveway, being pursued by Leatherface and with his chainsaw, which incidentally, apparently he literally had to run around with a live chainsaw.
Yeah,
which,
I was reading that. That is like, I guarantee if I had to do that, I would absolutely like do something,
I would cut
some
my
damage
own face
to
off
somebody
within about 30 seconds.
I don't know how they filmed all that. Like, I mean, yeah, she's, her character's so interesting too, because at the very end when she does escape, like this actually is really drawn out. That's the longest kind of bit of kind of drawn out violence is everything that happens to Sally at the end. But when she gets rescued, she's in the back of like a pickup truck, and she has this look on her face. She's got blood on her, she's completely disheveled, and it's like she's laughing like kind of like a maniac, as you might say, hysterically. She's laughing hysterically, and there's that like adrenaline release and relief, and you're like, this person has been forever changed, and that feels really real to you. I think
that's what I genuinely am interested to see, like how they take the character in this sequel, because with the Halloween reboot that kind of kicked off in 2018 and is now part of this like new trilogy, it was a very interesting choice with Jamie Lee Curtis's character to make her essentially like the kind of survivalist, where she's like set up her whole home setup as like the trap that will get Michael.
He does only seem to turn up on Halloween, so I'm pretty sure she didn't need to do that 364 days of the year.
Year round ready, but like one day of threat kind of thing. It's that's definitely her way of operating. But I think like given that that's happened so recently in the kind of horror franchise, are they going to go samey with how she kind of survives? And is it the fear of a threat of him coming back and all that? So.
And I am obviously not saying that we have perfected this, but it is interesting that both this and then the look at Sally, played by Alwyn, we have kind of moved into a time where we're, you know, women don't drop off the face of the earth after they're 35 or have to be Tom Holland's mother or whatever, or Tom Holland's sexy aunt, a la Spider-Man. Like, I think we have gotten better largely through TV, but it's also, I think, creeping into film at acknowledging that women have lives beyond being young, sexy and hot. I mean, obviously, Jamie Lee Curtis is still extremely sexy and hot. But like, I think, and I also think there is something really interesting in exploring that idea of decades of trauma, that it isn't just, as you say, you escape and that's it, you know, you escape, well done,
back to life.
Yeah,
although I would say that there was a little bit of that in this one, when in that opening scene, the whole incident with the hitchhiker in the van, and then she just goes back to her book about like Saturday.
Yeah, they all
like,
seem really chill about,
there was a very unfazed to that, but like, at least the rest of the trauma, they can
show. It's like, this man cut one of you and then also like burnt a photo of you like in your presence, and and it's like, well, back to Mercury in retrograde.
Yeah,
that,
were they just kind of bumping into way like weirder people? Was it like more accepted that like the world is just full of kind of strangeness? Because, you know, like,
I think
back
there
then,
was,
you know,
just
the internet
that real
and stuff, you
I'm
know?
Sure no harm will come of it kind of
like,
thing.
You know, people are a bit odd sometimes, and like, and also maybe the idea that like, you want, you know, if you did pick up, say, a guy like the guy they picked up, the hitchhiker, who progressively gets stranger and more odd as things go on, and then does that kind of act of mini act of violence or whatever, you might also want to like move swiftly on from it and just be like, we're just going to pretend that this guy, you know.
Yeah. And there is that idea of, if you acknowledge it, like it actually happened, or it could get worse. To circle back a little, with that kind of in mind, to circle back to the end, I accidentally covered myself in glory watching this, because as Sally is like desperately limping down and the guys are getting closer and closer, and like, I did feel she was the final girl and she would survive. And I was like, her only way out of this is if they get hit by a truck. So I was extremely proud of that. And also, just to kind of touch on, the only black character we see in this film is the truck driver who drives, I think it's Black Maria or Black Mariah at the truck, who saves her life, who throws a wrench at Leatherface in like with a very good aim that I would not possess. My adrenaline would be, you know, it would end, I don't even know where it would end up, but does not get a single line of dialogue, and she totally abandons him, and that's it.
I thought that
so
was
so it's like,
it
justice like, for the Black Mariah truck driver.
Totally. It was like they were trying to, there was a sense at the last bit, even though the film's really short, not really short, but a good length of time, that there was a drawing out of it, like, so you're like, she's gonna get free. No, she's not gonna get free. And it was like trying to kind of push it on.
Push-pull kind of the whole way.
Yeah. And I think there was a level, this is going to sound obviously mad given the film we're discussing, there's a level of realism that in that, because I think there is a tendency, and it's this, you know, fake trope of what actually makes a strong female character. It isn't necessarily that she's a daft hand with a machete. It's like, there was no moment where Sally was going to turn around and fight off these two men. You know, that wasn't going to happen. So it was real, like, how is she going to get out of this? And it was almost a deus ex machina kind of thing with this truck. That was like the, because they were incredibly close to catching her, and then it was something like freakishly mad that happened that stopped them. And then the hitcher is hit by this truck and killed, and Leatherface is just left cursing the sky and waving his very dangerous chainsaw.
Yeah, I did like his like swinging choreography. It was very like interpretive dance kind of feel.
And I feel it was very much this poor man, Gunnar Harrelson, is that how you say his name? I think he's Icelandic and he's like 7 feet tall, was very much just handed this chainsaw and gone, figure it out, which, like, God willing, would not happen on a film set today. But it is just that absolute sort of laissez-faire attitude of, again, if you're making a film in your 20s where you're like, I'm sure no harm will come of it, here.
Take this real chainsaw and try not to kill anybody with it. Yeah, his you were saying there, his movements and like his body language is really interesting, because he doesn't really talk. He kind of makes
and you don't actually
noises.
See his actual face at any
point. No, so he's like this big mystery, and you know there's something going on with him, and you're like, what's happening here? And it's like, he is this big lumbering kind of figure. And it was interesting.
He's a very physical presence. Yeah,
yeah, he really is. Just kind of, I think as a character, it's, you can see why people are so fascinated with him and why he would keep returning, but also, you know, to go back to your sympathies for him, you can see how
this is going to haunt me for the rest of my life.
You can see though that he's, that there are those kind of sad, weird things about it. But I don't know what you thought about the scene at towards the end. The kind of one that I found the hardest to watch, really, or one of the ones I found hardest, was when they have Sally at the the table, dinner basically table. The dinner table, they're all sitting down to eat what we presume is human sausages, and she's there kind of tied onto a chair, and then they want her killed and they want the grandfather to kill her, and that scene goes on for, it felt like ages with all these
it's
attempts
so uncomfortable
to kill her. Really
and
tense.
Like we said at the beginning, it is one of these things where like, this film is such a mad film, and it's real like, granddad's here, grandpa's the best at killing, you know. So, and this, like, this guy is literally a living corpse, he can barely hold the hammer, but then he really comes to life when they cut Sally's finger and there's blood and they put it in his mouth and he starts sucking the finger. It is so deeply unsettling, and as you say, it goes on too, but you feel like it's a deliberate choice that it goes on too long, because you want to curl up in a ball watching it.
There's something about that scene where you really start to lose hope about her likelihood of escape. Like, compared to, as you said, like that running down the driveway bit, you kind of, there's a little bit of a like, go girl, keep running, you can do this. But like, not 100% sure where, like, it's still very
there
remote,
doesn't appear to be a way out, and they're gaining on her and she can't run properly.
Yeah, but
two of them
when she's tied up and they're like in their full crazy ritual together, you just really are like,
it's like the world's most awkward family dinner. It's like having dinner in a friend's house and it occurs to you that like, they are incredibly strange, but you just have to like smile politely. But it's like that, it's like, you know, the true
my
true
family doesn't get
mirror
this into board
games.
The whole thing, and I think it's kind of summed up by the cook saying that like, there are some things you got to do, it doesn't mean you have to like it. And I think that almost more applies to Leatherface than him, but they have absolutely convinced themselves, probably through the upbringing of Corpse Grandad, that this is what they have to do to survive. Like, there isn't any alternative. It's presented to them as that there's, as they truly believe there is no alternative to be doing what they're doing. Now, I do think the cook and the hitcher do like it, definitely.
They get a bit of something out of it. Like,
they get something out of it, but it is really interesting that, and I think there's an awful lot in that in terms of capitalism, in terms of like the abandonment of rural communities and whatever that you could, and even in terms of like the meat industry and whatever and how it treats people, that you could read into it. And then obviously it just works as a truly, truly creepy horror film.
Yeah, like if you really want to look into it in terms of like the meat allegory and stuff, then you really could see a huge amount there that could be like an advertisement for vegetarianism, you know what I mean? Or the idea that like, actually human meat isn't that different to animal meat, or like, you know, the kind of
this is what's
going to
get you cancelled now. I may be a Leatherface apologist, but Aoife's there going cannibalism for the win.
No, I'm definitely not for cannibalism. I was a vegetarian, so I'm like,
you have very pure credentials.
I have very pure credentials there. But, and I don't know, I suppose there are probably people who are like, after reading into all of these things with it, but you could read it as that. And I mean, that probably would have been a period of time too, again, if we're talking about the 70s, where like, and the hippie movement, vegetarian movement would have been particularly like, kind of crunchy vegetarian movement.
And I think it would have only been starting, you know, in its infancy, as it, like, I know obviously George Bernard Shaw was like, famously vegetarian or whatever, like, I know it wasn't invented, but I think it is something that became slightly less like, you know, one in a million kind of thing, and slightly
less
more
weird
mainstream. David, do you want to cut to your favourite segment there?
Yeah, I think we're gonna have to move into my part, which, Andy, can you cue the music? What's in the box? Yes, so it is What's in the Box.
Can I say one really small little thing about that? That's obviously from Seven, right?
Excellent.
I got that completely spoiled by a Lemonhead song. This is a spoiler for anybody who hasn't seen Seven, sorry. There's a Lemonhead song and the lyrics are, "Here comes Gwyneth's head in a box." And I was always like, what's this about?
Why?
Hadn't seen Seven at the time, watched Seven, understood what exactly
Pivotal
was
moment
in the box. Anyway, so yeah, thanks, Evan.
So you see, in the context of our podcast, What's in the Box is the part where I go through mostly my childhood bedroom, but what I'm referring to as the archives, to find something related to the movie that we're covering in each episode. So with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, what I found was a copy of the student newspaper that I started in fourth year as part of the Gashka, which, for people outside of Ireland who may not have heard this, also called the President's Award, is one of these things where you do a series of activities to get acknowledged for extracurricular. But I got away with doing a school newspaper as like the community involvement one. I feel like a lot of other people did like work in a nursing home or did something like genuinely helpful to a community.
You just,
I
just cracked your knuckles and said, let's go, in front of your computer at home.
Exactly. So I was editor-in-chief and I did have a staff under me. But
oh God, were you a tyrant? Were you a despot? Like,
picture me.
Yeah, I am teenage David with some power.
Power, yeah, worrying no, thought. Unhealthy. But what I found in this, in issue one, my review of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake from 2003-04 with Jessica Biel, yeah. Jonathan Tucker, Eric Balfour, Andrew Briniarski.
I don't know. Oh, I don't know who those last three people are, so you can call them whatever you want.
But yeah, I gave it a rating of 2 out of 10. Did not enjoy this movie at all. And I'll just read like an excerpt from it. Was Marcus Nispel's remake, quote fingers there,
you bitch,
of the classic horror film The Texas Chainsaw Massacre poses the question, what made him want to do a version of this classic? He came, he saw, he butchered.
Oh, meow. The shame. Okay, I love it. All. I love it.
And then close the review with, to call this movie dismal is an understatement. I jumped once. That was during the credits when I looked down the road to see a very scary looking guy staring back at me. Do yourself a favor. There are a lot of good movies in the cinema now that can make you feel happier, smarter, more excited, or more scared. This is not one of them. Don't let it kill 98 minutes of your life.
Well, to be fair, at least it was also short.
Yeah,
I remember I was over at a friend's house and their brother was watching that. I hadn't seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre, so I only saw the scene, which I think was the meat hook scene. It seemed to be shot entirely at the level of Jessica Biel's boobs, which were in a tight white vest. And the 70s tradition, there did not appear to be a bra. But it just felt so on the nose exploitative, as opposed to like any sort of, you know, like latent or subtle sexuality that you might have had in the first one. Like, I think there was one point where you couldn't even see her face and it was just her chest.
Yeah, that's the Eli Roth era of kind of torture porny stuff was way more present in the remake. I think the verdict would be steer clear of that one. And I think as a group, we'd probably all say recommend on the original.
Like, are you glad you saw it, or was it something you endured?
Okay, I have to say that, like, there's a few, and I think I said this at the start as well, there's a few horror films that I waited ages to see, like The Exorcist, and even though they creeped me out during the creepy bits, I was really glad I saw them, because I was like, this is a great film, oh my god, I love it, I want to go to those steps where it was filmed and all that sort of stuff. This film definitely was probably like the most horrifying, scary, creepy, unsettling, I'd say, of all them that I saw, but I would definitely still recommend it because it's a seminal film. So it's like, I'm like, I have to see this film because I won't understand all the references from other films that I enjoy.
Yeah, and
that
I think horror is an incredibly self-referential
totally
genre.
Like,
well,
you know,
take Scream and just Scream, how exactly deep they went on that as a concept. Yeah,
and actually I really want to rewatch Scream because obviously I would watch them when they came out, but like that was about a million years ago, so you know, I think that might show me some bits that I didn't even realize were from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I would recommend watching it, but I would say be prepared, don't watch it on your own, turn on the lights if you want, and maybe just like look away if you need to at the like particularly gross bits, but it's actually not as bad as you think it's going
to be. Say if you are a person who doesn't love gore, and I would include myself and yourself, it's easy because you're thinking of kind of current horror standards to think that this is going to be horrific in that sense, but it's actually not. It is very strong in kind of the power of suggestion.
Yeah, like Squid Game is more gross than this. There's like a scene in Squid Game where you see someone's brains out of like a cracked skull, and that's on Netflix, and anybody can watch it.
I am the last person alive not to see Squid Game, so again, you've given me more fuel not to. And just one last question for you, Aoife. Obviously, this is the last one to see. Is there a film that you have seen that you are fond of that, you know, really resonates with you that you think more people should see?
I saw, and again, maybe this is like, yeah, I suppose maybe some people listening to this will have heard this, be like, this is obvious to them, but there's a film called Gas Food Lodging that came out in the 90s. And I think Fairuza Balk is in it, and it's like
90s queen of our hearts.
I'm pretty sure she's in it. If she's wrong, you can edit that bit out. But it's about a mother and two daughters who live in this like rural town, I think in kind of middle America. There's like, you know, tumbleweed going, you know, across the road at some point. And it focuses on the life of one of the daughters who's like a young teenager. And I just loved it so much because I just thought it really captured like teenage life and the kind of the troubles and sadness of living in a small rural town and trying to like really badly escape where you're stuck and it's just a really lovely film that really stuck with me. So it's called Gas, Food, Lodging. And I have a Woman Under the Influence poster above me here in my room. That's my other
She does, listeners. It's true.
I love that film so much. So yeah, there's that too.
I think I'll throw into the mix what is a film that is also unsettling, but not massively violent, and is probably my all-time favourite Irish film because I was a very weird teenager. Disco Pigs, which is obviously version of the play which was Cillian Murphy's breakthrough role, and he reprises that role of Pig in the film. And again, it's quite short, but it is himself and Elaine Cassidy in the film. I think it was, she wasn't in the play originally, it was Eileen Walsh. Yeah. I think it's something that, on, you know, I own it on DVD because it was like 16-year-old Kate's birthday present, I think, because I saw it in the cinema and I was just blown away. Wow. But it is one, I think, that has, obviously Cillian Murphy has soared to very high heights and Elaine Cassidy has had a very successful career also. But I think it is one that is kind of forgotten about when we talk about Irish film a little bit, unless we're going for a real deep cut. So I would definitely recommend seeing the origin of Cillian Murphy's truly incredible cheekbones and their origin story, which is Disco Pigs.
And I think I'll have to jump in with like horror.
Sorry, because
I'm like, everything I'm going to mention people are going to have seen already. There's no deep cuts in the horror genre I'm going to be coming up with here. Sorry, lads.
But no, the deep cut I have is a French horror film, which I know in Ireland it was released under the title Switchblade Romance.
Oh, yes, yes,
but
yes.
It was High Tension in the US.
That sounds very what it says on the tin. It's like, do you want to feel really tense for this entire film?
The American was actually a more direct translation of the French, which was Haute Tension. But it is a very typical horror movie premise of this killer hunting people down in a kind of rural setting. But there's less stupid people, I would say. There's quite a number of intelligent people, just a very ruthless killer. And I'm big music fan, and the use of a certain Muse track on the soundtrack for it stood out to me. Yeah, it's definitely my pick in the horror genre.
I have just remembered, I know we probably need to finish up, but I've just remembered a film that actually is super creepy, that doesn't have any violence in it, that I totally would recommend it. I don't know if you've seen it. I think it's a Belgian film about a guy who picks up his girlfriend goes missing when they're on a trip at a garage, and it's one of the most chilling things I've ever seen. I will tell you the name, but you can tweet it out whenever this episode goes
We'll drop it in the show notes, as they say.
But I think if you want to be really, really creeped out in a non-violent way, that one is a really good one. Of course, me not remembering the names of no help to anybody, but...
Yeah. And it's certainly not, I would say, underrated, but in terms of classics of the genre, Psycho is well worth... Like, Alfred Hitchcock, not a very nice man, very good filmmaker.
Yeah.
And like, how many of the things in the... And is it horror? Is it thriller? You know, is it just like an impending sense of dread with a very, very specific soundtrack through the entire thing, which he does, like, he deploys when nothing is happening. So you're there all the time, not knowing when something bad is going to happen. Because she can just be, you know, Janet Leigh's there just driving in her car, and then suddenly you get the in the background and you're like, oh God, what's going to happen? But to see... Where, firstly, I think it is arguably a better standalone film than the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but I think it is something that is really worth watching if you want to see, as you were saying, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, how we got from here to there. I think they could be like a really interesting double bill to pair together.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Aoife, thanks so much for your time. Hopefully you're a little bit happy that you're no longer the last one to see Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and like, well done for facing your fears for the benefit of us and the listeners. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and apologies to anybody in advance who watches it on our best and is like, but I do think it's worth watching. Thank you for making me watch it.
Thanks, Aoife. Chat soon.
Lovely, and that was our chats with Aoife Barry. So Kate, after experiencing all of that, are you any less afraid of the horror franchise?
I find it like unsettling, you know, as opposed to hiding under the couch kind of thing. Now, I did watch it with three other people, and I would probably continue that in any of my horror experimentation. I would probably continue to not watch it on my own in the house in the dark, and then there's a noise in the basement, and so on and so forth. We don't even have a basement, but you know.
But what if it suddenly appeared? That's the power of horror.
It's a liminal space in the basement that sucks me into a parallel dimension.
So with the sequel is coming out on February 18th on Netflix.
And do we know anything about it?
Yeah, very, very little information, in fairness. Like, last month, the first trailer that I've seen dropped for it. It's a kind of it's similar to like the first Scream trailer. It's a chase of someone about to be killed and doesn't really give a huge amount of plot details. So that, yeah, that one's out next month. So for folks who enjoyed the refresh on this one, that's definitely recommended viewing going forward. I can't wait for it.
And to continue our classic films featuring pointy objects, our next episode is going to be Aoife Martin tackling The Seven Samurai.
That was a movie that I thankfully got to see in the cinema. But hopefully with a few more episodes getting recorded in the next few weeks, there are some potential ones that we might be able to see in the cinema.
Yeah, potentially together. I mean, it's a big day. And also, as mentioned, I've seen nothing and you've seen everything, which should play in very nicely to our last one to see Oscar nom special.
Yes, exactly. So the nominations will be out in 2 weeks' time, 7th or 8th of February. So we'll definitely get an episode, I assume, with our reactions and responses to them. I personally feel this year, I don't know what I'm going to have seen from the Oscars list because it's been such a weird year with cinema releases and streaming. What's eligible for it? I feel like I don't even know.
Obviously they did, was it last year or the year before? Because Out of Time Has No Meaning, they have opened up the field somewhat to things from streaming platforms, which is obviously a stumbling block before and probably in a timely manner to coincide with COVID. So it'll be really interesting to see that.
And even with the Golden Globes fiasco and how that was handled this year, I feel like we don't have like the same signposts coming into the Oscars of...
And yeah, Jared Leto got a SAG nom somehow, so...
That's 2022 chaos for you.
Yeah, I apologise to the people of Italy. Yeah, I did see West Side Story on Monday, me and the boozy retirees of Birmingham. It's a lovely cinema called The Everyman. There's a couple of them around the place. I don't know if you've ever been to the one. There's one, at least one in London.
They're the fancy armchair cinemas, aren't they?
Exactly. Yes. My favourite genre of cinema. But it was like 2 o'clock and I just went along on my Toblerone looking for a bit of escapism, and everybody else who was coming in was like clutching like full bottles of wine. And I was like, fair play to you guys. Follow your bliss. I actually thought it was excellent, and I'm kind of surprised how it doesn't seem to have done particularly well, because a la the famous Chicago winning Best Picture the year of 9/11, when things are a bit shit, we always look for escapism. And it is excellent. Steven Spielberg can make a film. Who knew? I really, really, really enjoyed it. And also having, obviously, the Jets and the other Hispanic characters played by Hispanic people.
What a novel idea.
I know. Maybe there's an element of, and not to spoil West Side Story, which is based on Romeo and Juliet. So I kind of feel like if you don't know this,
Shakespeare
I'm
spoilers
safe.
Are okay at this
point. Yeah. It is obviously a more tragic genre of musical. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there is something in that, but like it really is excellent. Yeah. So I was kind of surprised, and I enjoy a musical, but I wouldn't be a musical expert. But I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was really well done. The acting was good. I thought Ansel Elgort was really good, and I kind of feel much like Armie Hammer in the trailers for the upcoming Death on the Nile. Oh, yeah. He was really pushed to the back in the promo because there is some uncertainness around conduct, I believe, around Ansel Elgort.
Oh, no.
But I thought he was really, really good. I think Maria is a really difficult role because it is a bit milk and mild. And then obviously it was also somewhat rewritten. So there is a role for Rita Moreno, who is an EGOT and we stan, but who would have gotten her Oscar for the original West Side Story. So that I think it is highly unlikely she will not be nominated, because I think it is the type of story that Hollywood really, really like. But yeah, she was the original Anita, and the Anita in this version, played by Ariana DeBose, is just fantastic. And to tie back to what we're saying about Aaron Sorkin, she is a dancer, and my God, do her legs go all the way down to the floor. But her acting is also fantastic, and there are some really interesting choices made. Some like the largely faithful to the story, but a few tiny tweaks that I think are really interesting. So I'll be interested to see what it is nominated for, but I am surprised that it hasn't done particularly well.
I think, well, to be honest, even the performance side of things, in December when it was released, the lower numbers and attendance at cinemas and everything, I feel like we're only really seeing the impact of that now, where like release dates are getting pushed out, and the likes of Morbius, I think, is that moved to next month. That was originally
Jared Leto again.
He's everywhere. So I think that there were probably a few films that they were trying to squeeze in for like Oscar eligibility and making sure that they got the release date out. But I think, as I say, that whether people are actually going to the cinema and whether it's showing up in the numbers in new releases, that may be part of the influencing factor as to why it's not doing so well. I have heard great things from like the critical side about it.
Yeah, I was part of the reason that I was like, oh yeah, I will go and see this is that it was really well reviewed. So it was interesting to see. And then I suppose on a parting note, just saw a tweet before we started recording from Natasha Lyonne announcing that she was going to be the new Batman. And I think we would all much rather see that film.
I'm very excited to dive into this much deeper and see whether she's trolling all of us or whether I'm...
Oh no, she's. It was 100% a joke, but I would just really like a superhero film where that you can actually see what's happening, because the new Batman once again looks like it's that Christopher Nolan look where it's been dipped in the Merc filter.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, not to sound 100 years old, I'm like, who is that? What is happening? Like, we need a return to Camp Batman.
Yeah. They even make a joke in the new Scream movie about things being well lit in the 90s. I'm like, maybe we liked that.
Yeah, maybe we liked being able to see what was happening. Who knew?
Well, I will continue to watch films that I can see until I see you in person. So, safe travels.
Oh, I'm very excited. I
hope it all goes well.
Thank you. I'm on the ferry, like Saoirse in Brooklyn. I'm coming home to you.
Amazing. Take care.
This podcast was brought to you by The Shift. For more like this, check out theshift.ie.